In today's lecture, I want to explore a historical fact, a basic historical fact about the concept of the hero. And that is that heroes in the ancient Greek world were not only told about in epic drama and the other media we're going to see, they were also worshipped. This is a matter of Greek religion. And for the entire historical span of what we are studying, we can go as far back as the 8th century BCE or further back, and all the way forward to the author that I'm featuring today in item C of the handout, Philostratus Heroicus. I hope you have the handout with you. And his date is 200 AD. So all the way from, let's say, the 800s to 200 AD, people were worshipping heroes. And if I were to summarize in one sentence what my research trajectory has been over the last 25 years, it has been to show that the way people worship heroes is relevant to the way heroes are talked about in epic and in tragedy and in the other media. And if you think, well, so what? This is not obvious. And it's not obvious simply from reading the literature. And that's why today I go out of my way to spell this out. I'd like to give you a very brief crash course on hero cult as a historical phenomenon in ancient Greek civilization. And take good notes, because the notes you take in class, although they'll be supplemented by even richer notes that I've taken myself for you, and which you will see on the splash page on your website, nevertheless, make things more immediate. Sometimes I can say things in a very few words that take me a very long time to say in what I write. So this is a short version. You'll see a longer version just by opening up the website and looking at the splash page. When I say religion, I mean the interaction of ritual and myth. And I've already defined ritual and myth for you. If you'd like to review that for the midterm, that too is revisited in the splash page. Here's some very, very basic things, 15 of them, about hero cult. Number one, hero cults were local, fundamentally local. That is to say, it's local religious practice, it's local interaction with myth and ritual. And even some of the heroes that are best known to us from the Iliad and Odyssey and from the tragedies we have read and will read can be worshipped in local cult. Then there'll be other local cult heroes that you never hear of anywhere else. And they're male cult heroes, they're female cult heroes, they're even underage baby cult heroes. This all has to do with a fundamental aspect of ancient Greek religion. To repeat, it's a historical fact. Number two, ordinarily, the hero cult was based on the fact, the understood fact, that the body of the given hero was, if I may say it quickly, planted in the local Mother Earth. That is to say, without the body as an anchor to the cult, without the body as an anchor to the ritual and myth, there is no hero cult. And the word for body is soma, S-O-M-A. And sometimes the locals may not have had the whole body, they might have had a part of the body, like a head or a thumb, or even by metonymy, an article of clothing, a weapon, something that the hero had touched sometime during their life. Touching is a really good metonymy, anything that has to be connected to the hero. Number three, this body, or part of the body, or parts touched by the body, was considered a talisman of fertility and prosperity to the local worshippers, to the locals. And fertility was viewed primarily in terms of plant life, vegetation, okay? Especially in terms of what you harvest from the plant life. So it could be a field, a garden, a grove, an orchard, a vineyard, etc., etc. So that's your primary way of imagining fertility. It's also, of course, animal fertility, and that has to do not only with what happens to your domesticated animals, but how well you hunt, or how badly you hunt. And those of you who saw the film, The Map of the Human Heart, there's a beautiful example of fertility as game that is produced by the goddess of the sea. And then lastly, a little switch. Ritual substitution. Okay? Can you still hear me? And notice how clearer it is. Clearer, but needs to be louder. Now better. Okay. So we're still on number three, the talisman of fertility and prosperity. It's not that I have to rewind everything, do I? Good. Number four. The marker, if I can call it this, the marker of the body that is planted in the local earth is called the sema, S-E-M-A. And ordinarily a sema is a tomb. Okay. Number five, there are other kinds of marking too for the body. You could have a sign, like a secret signal, a token, or a picture, a painting. And the word for this kind of marking is also sema. And that's where we get the meaning semantics by way of the Greek idea of meaning. This is so fundamental to meaning that to mark where the body is has basically to do with the Greek word for meaning. So that was five. Number six, the marking could be a secret. Why? Because the marking is sacred, and usually sacred things in many communities are considered secret. And if it is secret, that means that the local community will screen the information about the marking to outsiders. And outsiders are not only people who are aliens or foreigners, but there could be people in your community who do not yet know the secret. So what's the word I'm looking for? Tara, initiation. In other words, the sema can be a key to initiation, right? It could be a secret to...
You remember it from Iliad 1, where every time Achilles is...
water, wine, oil, milk, emulsified honey, combinations of those, the blood of a sacrificed animal, the fresh blood of a sacrificed animal. Again, either meat, so to speak, or mixed in with other ingredients. When you pour blood, what's the purpose? It's to make contact with the consciousness of the dead. And in some cases, we have archaeological evidence that they would have tubes leading from the surface of the earth to the mouth of the corpse so that you can pour the blood directly in. The blood goes in, you have about 5 minutes of contact while the batteries are activated, then the blood gets used up, the consciousness is gone. What do you call the opinion of a hero when you pray to a hero like this? You call it, are you ready? Diagnosis. Why diagnosis? Because heroes were thought to be healers, that promote prosperity and fertility. They would be given secret names like the physician. One such secret name is Jason. Are any of you who are called Jason? Maybe this is not the time to fess up to it, but anyway. Number nine, when you sacrifice to a hero, there's a Jason. When you sacrifice to a hero, you ordinarily look down. You have to have your eyes looking down on the earth under your feet. When you sacrifice to God, you're supposed to look up to the sky. This will become very important when we discuss another film later on, having to do with people who tend to have their eyes fixed on the sky versus people who have their eyes fixed on the local earth. In the reading that we're doing today on Philostratus, this 200 CE or AD person, in Philostratus there's actually an exchange at the very beginning of your reading where it turns out that the Phoenician keeps looking up at the sky, he's looking for the stars so he can get his bearings, whereas the so-called vine dresser, the vineyard keeper, is always looking down on the earth, concentrating on the place where the local hero is planted. Okay, number 10, when you sacrifice to a hero, you can use special taboo words for I sacrifice, and one of them actually means I participate in the guilt. I participate in the guilt. I participate in the pollution. Can't explain that now, but that shows you we still have a lot of explaining to do about the religious dimensions of the hero. I give you a fuller version of this in the notes that are on the splash page. Number 11, ordinarily if you sacrifice to, let's say, a male hero, what do you sacrifice? A ram. I say that because remember you saw the picture of Patroclus as a ram in the slide lecture with the throat slit, sacrificially slit. Number 12, ordinarily when you sacrifice to a hero, you sacrifice into a depression in the earth. So you sacrifice below earth level into a depression. Ordinarily when you sacrifice to a god, a sky god, it's an elevation above the earth. And we have words like altar. Okay. And I give you some really good examples from the Olympics in the expanded notes that you can check if you're interested on the website. Number 13, the sacred space where the hero is worshipped can be coextensive, that is to say, shared with the sacred space of the god who is the divine antagonist of the hero, and that seems sort of counterintuitive to us. Why should you worship the hero and the antagonist god of the hero in exactly the same sacred space, in exactly the same local earth? But this is one of the things we have to grapple with as we read tragedy. We're going to keep coming back to this very interesting historical fact. Number 14, when you're sacrificing to a hero and you know that his body or her body is in your local earth, okay, you think of them as dead, right? But there's no contradiction in ancient Greek religion about simultaneously thinking of that dead hero as alive and immortalized in a beautiful place beyond our time and space. Okay? And that beautiful place will have all sorts of different local names because depending on the local cult, you have different ways of imagining this. And ancient Greeks were very self-conscious and even embarrassed about talking about how they imagined their local heroes in this, may I say it, paradise-like existence beyond our time and place. But one thing that all of these places have in common, and I've studied dozens of them, is that they are always imagined in a beautiful vegetal setting. It can be a beautiful garden, it can be a beautiful vineyard, etc., etc. It could be a beautiful field. All right? And then number 15, the hero can be thought of as potentially resurrected, that is to say, coming back to life at the fullness of time, sometime beyond our time and our place. And this is why you can simultaneously think of the hero as dead in your local earth, but also immortalized somewhere else. Or, and this is the most interesting part, by way of a miracle, the hero can just appear as a phantom, as a phantasm, or depending on local belief, the real thing, in your own life at a specially sacred moment. And they like to appear, they like to, ready for the word, make their epiphanies in sacred moments, when you're praying, when you're sacrificing, when you're taking in the beauties of nature, all those things would work, okay? And you see why I've been harping on the term metonymy as well as metaphor all the time, because you see, even in these religious concepts, this constant obsession with what things the hero has touched personally, which then becomes sacred just because they touched it. And so if they hang out in a sacred place, the whole place is sacred, all right? And similarly, if we're going to get into this, any kind of bodily association of the hero, like let's say the way a hero breathes, will be connected literally with the spot in the garden, the natural phenomena. So the hero's breath will be intimately connected to the breeze that's blowing in a beautiful garden. And so by metonymy you can say, oh my, that hero has sweet breath, and all sorts of other almost uncomfortably religious, sentimental even, feelings that worshippers express to these beings that are not gods, but they're not humans either. Well, this was a 15-minute crash course. You'll see 15 minutes worth of notes that supplement what I just said if you look at the website. Now, what I'm really doing is defamiliarizing our concept of the hero up to now, because we keep thinking of them as characters in epic, characters in tragedy. But look at the passage A in the handout. Here, the disguised Odysseus is comparing his wife Penelope to a just king, a king who is the upholder of justice. Okay? And if you study footnote 1 in your handout, you will see that the Greek idea of justice, of social justice, is regularly metaphorized compared with a beautifully tended garden or field or grove or whatever it is. And that in turn is regularly metaphorized as a straight line, as something where you just know your directions. The opposite is the word hubris, which I also give you in footnote 1, which is an untended garden, something that has been allowed to grow wild, quote-unquote, all right? And that will be metaphorized also as a crooked line. So, straight line, good planting. Crooked line, bad planting. A straight line, justice, social justice. All presided over by the concept of the hero. And so imagine what a beautiful inos this is, and the visualization, what a beautiful sema this is, that Odysseus is projecting his own identity to his wife. He says, you're like a just king, and when a just king is in power. He rules, line 3 and following, over a great and valiant nation. The earth yields its wheat and barley, the trees loaded with fruit, the ewes bring forth lambs, and the sea abounds with fish by reason of his virtues. Beautiful metonymy between Odysseus and Penelope. Similarly with B, remember we've been talking about how difficult it is for Odysseus to be read, to be recognized by his near and dear ones, and how he has to start with the most simple relationships like his dog, and then work his way up from the dog to more and more and more complex relationships with those who are near and dear to him. And the hardest relationship to reconstruct is the relationship he had with his wife, interrupted for 20 years. So there's a lot of reconstructing to do. Or as Desi Arnaz used to say to Lucy, "Lucy, you've got a lot of splaining to do." Only this time it's Odysseus who has to do the explaining. And after Penelope, there's somebody who is even more difficult to reconstruct your relations with, and that's, it looks as if the top of Odysseus' ascending scale of affection as far as his near and dear ones are concerned, just in terms of how the plot develops, and that's his father. And we've seen how important fathers are, even in the name Patroclus, which means he who has the glory of the fathers. So it's maybe not a surprise to us that the hardest relationship for Odysseus to reconstruct is that with his father. So isn't it wonderful that when he meets him and when they have their click, their coming together of minds and hearts, it happens in a garden. And there's a beautiful description here of how Laertes, the father of Odysseus, is sad and grieving, right? And he stood under a tall pear tree, you see line 5, and began to weep. This is now Odysseus. And then he's wondering whether he should instantly identify himself or whether he has to play his usual game so that he can try to reconstruct genuinely the relationship. I'm emphasizing again that this is happening in a beautiful garden, a great orchard. I see, sir, he says, starting at line 244, if you're an excellent gardener, what pains you take with it. There is not a single plant, not a fig tree, vine, olive, pear, nor flower bed, but bears the trace of your attention. Again, I'm trying to defamiliarize the scene so you realize that this is not just a story about heroes. There's a hidden agenda about cult heroes, and there are lots of signals for us, the uninitiated, so that we can get initiated into this mentality of being a part of hero cult. That's what C is about as well, this strange piece by Philostratus. Now you might think, well, I'm taking Greek literature, so I read the Iliad, I read the Odyssey, I read Euripides as Heracles, then I read Philostratus as Heroikos. You go around the whole world, and you won't find any other place anywhere where people are studying Philostratus. In fact, this is the only English translation that is available. And it was done by two ex-heroes, TFs, both of whom are assistant professors, one of them in the Divinity School. People just don't read this. And so this is like a premiere. I can't tell you how excited I am about it, that you're reading this in English. Not only that, but I give you some of the key words untranslated. And imagine, if you will, that there's this beautiful vineyard, which also happens to be the sacred space of Prothesilaos. And Prothesilaos, as you see in footnote 3, was the first hero to die in the story of Troy. He jumps off the boat, he gets killed immediately. And he gets a hero cult. And his body is worshipped as a talisman of fertility and prosperity. Way into the date 200 CE or AD, he's still being worshipped. And he's worshipped because of what happened way back when in the story of Troy. And how is he worshipped? His body is anchored in this beautiful vineyard. And so you have this Phoenician sailor. Get it? He's uninitiated, he's not Greek, although he speaks perfect Greek. He speaks intellectual Ionic Greek. if you read at the beginning, that's all set up. And sure, he has his head and his eye fixed on the stars, whereas the local vineyard keeper has his eye firmly fixed on the ground. But the point is, the Phoenician is uninitiated, the local Greek vineyard keeper, or what do our translators call it, a vine dresser? The vine dresser is initiated. And I'd like to concentrate in particular on not just the religiosity, but the affection with which the worshiper speaks about the hero. And it almost makes us uncomfortable. I remember when I was a young man, I was a big fan of the Beatles. And then when the Beatles broke up, they would do strange things, like George Harrison would have a song called My Sweet Lord. And when you hear My Sweet Lord, you say, my God, he's got sentimental. And so you realize that there's a religious subtext. Okay? And so here, too, just look at this. The vine dresser calls him, line 2, the handsome Prothesilaos. And then the Phoenician says, what connection is there between you and Prothesilaos? And then he says, he lives here. Say, he lives here. And we farm together. Get it? We're working the land together. And the Phoenician, oh, he's so innocent. Has he come back to life, or what has happened? And you have this initiation word for understanding what resurrection is, anabionai here. And vine dresser says, he himself does not speak about his own experiences, stranger, except, of course, that he died at Troy because of Helen, but came back again to life in Phthia because he loved Laodamea. Well, if you reread the Iliad, you'll see he was on his honeymoon. He interrupts his honeymoon. He goes to Troy. He dies. And, well, there's more. So the Phoenician, being sort of uninitiated and out of it, says, and yet he said to have died after he came to life again and to have persuaded his wife to follow him. So it looks like after coming back to life, he dies again, then he comes back to life again with his wife. Look at the vine dresser's mystical initiation suggesting, same alike answer. But now he returned afterwards too. He does not tell me, even though I wanted to find out for a long time. He is hiding, he says, some secret of the fates. Okay? And then look at the Phoenician. He says, by Athena, I don't believe it. And the word that's used here, pistero, is what is used in the Apostles' Creed for I believe in God. This is, of course, pre-Christian language, but you can see the connections between pre-Christian ways of dealing with secrets of initiation, and then Christian ways of dealing with analogous things. Okay. Turn the page. Now, oh boy. He says, "There's hora." You see line 2. Remember, that's the concept of the hero. That seasonality. That's everything coming together. And it happens again. Hora. You see about 10 lines down where I have footnote 4. How diverse is the beauty of your property, and how lush have the clusters of grape grown. How well arranged are all the trees. How divine is the fragrance of the place. Okay. Indeed, I think that the walkways which you have left unfilled are pleasing. And this idea of associating everything that's seasonal, everything that comes together, everything that has to do with the concept of the hero, with the beauty of the vineyard here, just brings everything together in this sort of very easy to get acquainted with narrative. Look at the footnote I have here. In modern Greek, the ordinary word for pretty or beautiful is oreos, orea, and it comes from hora, this heroic concept. So isn't it amazing that even in modern Greek, the word for beautiful is defined in terms of the concept of hero cults, if you trace it all the way back. And if you go back to your passage, you see about 5 lines higher up from where I've just given you the hora passage with footnote 4. So this is about, let's say 7 lines down, seven lines down from the top of the page, you see where it says, "Let us enter, for I suppose a pleasant breath comes from the plants." You see that? And again, if you read on, you'll see that the breath that comes from the vegetation is the breath of the hero. So you have metaphor and metonym. And just to show you how this kind of thing survives, it's a strange thing for me to do, but I'm going to do a close reading from my head of a modern Greek poem by a Nobel Prize winner called George Seferis, S-E-F-E-R-I-S. And the poem is called Denial. And it starts with a beautiful beach, which is secret. Sto periali to crifo, jaspero san beristeri, and if white like a dove, bitsasa metto messimeri, we thirsted at noon, which is when heroes appear, we thirsted at noon, but the water was too salty to drink, mato nero crifo. Panos timamo tinsanti, all along the sand, the blonde sand, rapsa metonomatis, we wrote down her name. Okay. Orea, pus physic senobatis, beautiful, orea, this is that word, beautiful the way the breeze blew. Okay. And then the writing was extinguished, so you can, the waters sort of wash away her name that was written on the sand. Okay. Metikardia, with what heart? Ketipnoi, with what breath? And here the breath is both the breath of the wind, the breath of heroes. Tipotus, ketipathos, what passions and what desire? Pira metizoimas, we seized our life. And then there's this weird word that Greek teachers use when you make a mistake, lathos, which means blanking out of the mind. So everything stops, lathos. And then the last line, chalaxamezoi, and we changed life. We changed our life. And that goes back to a poem by Rilke, R-I-L-K-E, contemplating the archaic torso of an Apollo that's fragmented. So it's the beautiful body that is broken up and you only see part of it, the torso. And Rilke's poem says, Du musst dein Leben ändern, you must change your life. And so this is what Seferis is referring to. Okay, very intellectual. Now, if an intellectual Greek is reading this to you, it's like French intellectual sometimes, a lot of pursing of the lips, you know, it's like this. And you know, there's a hush in the audience. But remember, this is a song culture. So, okay, now imagine me being an impressionable 14-year-old. Hard to imagine, but anyway. And I once hear this Greek song. Because it turns out this Nobel Prize winner, very elitist poet, turned on the song culture so much that one of the most popular composers, I'm getting the tape ready, called Theodorakis, who was this populist, communist composer. His name is spelled Theodore, and then drop the final E and just add A-K-I-S, Theodorakis. He set this to music, okay? And I just want you to hear how the whole thing is again in this song culture, because this is one of the greatest hits of the modern Greek song culture in popular culture. And keep my microphone on, I'll keep commenting on this. It's Theodorakis' favorite singer who sings this, all this over again. And watch for the point where the singer says, beautiful, orea, that's the hora word, beautiful the way the sea breeze blew. Okay? Okay, Yancy? No, Yancy, no, not the video. This is the audio. We'll do the lament later. The lament comes later. Well, in fact, you know, while Yancy's getting ready, just signal me when you're ready. What I'm then going to do is in D, you see where we have, okay, now we'll do the song. Thank you. on the secret beach. White like a dove. Passion. We thirsted at noon. But the water was undrinkable. Too salty. We thirsted. At noon. But the water. A little instrumental. But notice the passion about thirsting at noon. And two more strophes. On the beach. The blonde beach. We wrote down her name. There it is. Beautiful, the way the breeze blew. And the lighting that we raised. They have the final stanza. What passion? Remember, that's the key thing. So it's like, beautiful, but beautiful. So it's like, what passion? Same part of the line. Okay? Here we go. With what heart? With what breath? What desires, what passion? We seize our life, you say, and we changed our life. No, we changed life. Lucko, blank out. And then finally, and we turn back. Thank you, Yancy. That ending, where he's referring to the German poet lines about you must change your life, he's really done quite a twist, because, to repeat, we seized our life. Then there's this strange word, lakos, meaning blanking out of memory, blanking out of total recall. And then you repeat the part about life, but now he says, and we changed life, not our life, we changed life. So there's this real shift once you have the blank out, once you've heard about the torso, the figure, and how it's mutilated, but you're trying to recover the entirety, and then you have the changing of life. So it's quite something, and what impresses me is the continuity of the religious, which is also the poetic sentimentality about nature, about a beautiful place, about the breeze being somehow the breath of somebody. Now I'm going to ruin it all by thinking of Maurice Chevalier, who sings, now this is French puckering of the lips, every little breeze seems to whisper Louise. Now that's bad sentimentality. I kind of like this other kind. Now, we go to passage B. This is Herodotus, the father of history. You know what? Herodotus, the father of history, also plays with every trick in the book about how to initiate people into hero cults. That's one of his favorite games. Except it's no game. This is serious. And it's like exploring the realm of the divine through looking at human history. And it all comes together in D. These two paragraphs in D tell you, as far as I'm concerned, everything you want to know about hero cult and how it relates to classical literature. It's all here. it's that good. But because it is compressed, we better have a lot of initiation. We really have to get used to this kind of mentality, which is why I gave you the historical background, which is why I gave you the emotional background of the Greek song culture. What I'd now like to do to give you a background to this is to show you a clip. Now we're going to do it, Yancy. And this is a clip from the film English Patient, which I urge you to see. You can see it Wednesday at 8 o'clock. English Patient is literally a guide to how to read Herodotus. And even if you didn't take Heroes, you would want to see it in order to understand Herodotus. It's that good. And what I'm going to show is just a very short segment from what you're going to see on Wednesday at 8, tomorrow at 8. And in this segment, we've just seen the credits roll by. So that's what we're going to see first. And I included this because the director happened to fall in love with Hungarian laments. And what you're hearing, you think is some kind of lament, but it's also simultaneously, I warned you about this, a love song, because laments and love songs go together. So this is somebody who's crying over how they've lost their true love. They've been searching the whole world to find the true love again. They'll do anything to get the true love back. And it's that yearning to get the true love back that isn't what the lament is all about. So because the clip is somewhat long, and I want to make sure I have some closing words about Herodotus, I'll show you just the end of the credits so you can hear just a little bit of the lament. I have a long analysis on the web page on what the lament is about, what he sings, what she's singing, etc. But here you'll see that, and then you'll see a moment where somebody is reading to the English patient straight from Herodotus, and what she is reading will introduce these two paragraphs in B. So the film is actually helping me set the context for the reading context for D. So, Yancy, if we could play it now. We can hear just a little bit of the lament.
Hume insisted that he would find some way to prove beyond dispute that his wife was fairest of all women. I will hide you in the room where you sleep, said Candace.
Candace
tells Gygias that the queen has the same practice every night. She takes off her clothes and puts them on the chair by the door to her room. And from where you stand, you will be able to gaze on her at your leisure. And that evening is exactly as the king had told him. She goes to the chair, removes her clothes one by one, until she's standing naked in full view of Gaiji. And indeed she was more lovely than he could have imagined. But then the queen looked up and saw Gygias concealed in the shadows. And although she said nothing, she shuddered. And the next day, she sent all for Gygias and challenged him. And hearing his story, this is what she said.
Off with his head.
She said, either you must submit to death for gazing on that which you should not, or else kill my husband who has shamed me, and become king in his place. So Gyges killed the king, married the queen, and becomes ruler of Lydia for 28 years. The end.
Yeah, right, the end. It's not the end. But, you notice how she said end, and it turns out that in the film we have to go full circle. I come, oh boy, to my favorite word, maybe in the whole course. It's the last footnote, five, the end. Except, this word, telos, means end only in a linear sense. in a circular sense, it means coming full circle. And if you read with me in footnote 5, it can also mean rounding out, like rounding out a story. Fulfillment, you know, where you don't understand something the first time, but then second, third, fourth time you understand it. Completion, ending, end, successfully passing through an ordeal, ritual, rite. This is the word for initiation into hero cults. This was the word that they used. And so, I go to a big question. What is it to be truly happy? This is what people like those great potentates that Catherine is telling about in the story were after. How to be the most happy, fortunate person in the whole world. And indeed, you have the wise man of Athens giving the answer. And he says the happiest person is telos. You see it? O King, line 4, it is telos the Athenian. And telos is the most orbios. And orbios is already an initiation word, a secret word, where if you don't get it, if you're uninitiated, it just means happy. If you do get it, if you're initiated, it means blessed in the sense of the blessed hero who is giving prosperity and fertility to the people who worship him or her, and the people who are blessed by metonymy because they are worshiping the hero. So underneath the surface, orbios is the key to what true happiness is. But if you're uninitiated, like this powerful king, the most powerful man in his time, and the way this film starts, this narrative, you don't get it. You're just thinking, you're measuring life in terms of material wealth and power and prestige, okay? And it's no accident that Herodotus deliberately uses a name that already conveys the secret, which is telos, initiation, into what is truly orbios, what is truly blessed. And the wise man uses the word in an understanding way, in a beneath the surface way. The uninitiated man doesn't get it because he thinks he's the most happy, the most fortunate person, not telos. So now you look at paragraph, the second paragraph. The king figures, all right, if I'm not the most happy person, maybe I'm the second most happy. So he asks the question again. And again, the answer is full of the agenda of hero cult. This time it's two twins, Cleobis and Biton, and they take the place of two sacrificial oxen. You see where it says, about 7 lines down on the second paragraph, that two oxen didn't come on time? This is a festival celebrating Hera, who is the goddess of Hora, the goddess of timeliness. And the two sacrificial animals, guess what happens to them at the end of the festival? Yes, they're slaughtered and eaten. They don't make it in time. So the two boys, who are athletes, undertake the ordeal of pulling the wagon of the priestess of the goddess of seasonality. And they pull the wagon, and then when they finish their ordeal, they die. They die. And when they die, everything comes together perfectly. And there's the word, which I glossed with footnote 5, they come to Ariston Telos. They come to the best Telos of them all. And that best Telos tells us everything we want to know about the hero and hero cult. That the hero is untimely, is off balance in life, and the hero has everything coming together for him or her at the moment of death. And if that moment of death happens perfectly, then that means that the hero gets hero cult. And if the hero gets hero cult, that means the hero will give prosperity and fertility to the community. The hero is orbios, blessed, and so is the whole community blessed. So from the standpoint of hero cult, from the standpoint of religion, it's that simple. And yet, Greek literature makes it hard for us by constantly asking us to decode this mystery, which you're already initiated in. So why should you be worried about midterms? All you have to worry about is to read carefully and to read and be engaged and tell me what you're reading. Don't tell me the concepts, tell me what you're reading. And I can hardly wait for you to take this midterm because it will be a very good telos in a good sense. But before that, if you want to help your midterm, come and see the film, because I really think it will help. So I hope to see you tomorrow. Thank you.